Dobré, už odpoledne, vzhledem k tomu, že se dívám na to, kde je tu zapsaný, tak nemá smysl zkoušet mluvit anglicky, takže vás tu vítám česky. Vítám tu dánského filmového badatele Kaspra Tyberga, který působí zejména v dánském filmovém ústavu. Kaspra Tyberg je jeden z největších odborníků na dějiny dánské kinematografie. Podílel se na, jako konzultant na řadě různých dokumentů, na restaurování filmů, ale zejména je to odborník na metodiku filmové historiografie a na dílo Karla Theodora Dreyera. Možná jako momentálně neexistuje větší odborník na dílo dánského tvůrce, režiséra Karla Theodora Dreyera. Kaspar Tyberg vlastně přislíbil, jsme velmi vděční, že přislíbil účast vlastně v rámci programu zahraničních hostů naší katedře a zároveň si připravil vlastně téma přednášek, které odpovídá tomu, co jsem tam mluvil, dánský jiný film, historie stylu a často příklady právě z díla Karla Theodora Dreyera a vlastně otázky, obecnější otázky psaní filmové historiografie. Takže thank you for for your lecture here and enjoy the lectures.
Thank you very much, I want to begin by thanking you, Radomir, and Masaryk University for having me here. It's a great privilege to be able to come here and present some of my my ideas about doing film history and about Danish silent cinema, and I hope that you will enjoy this. It's obviously a rather compressed program, but we'll see how that goes. So we'll be having 6 lectures over the next 3 days, and this is basically the program that I'll follow. And the lectures will sort of both cover Danish silent cinema relatively chronologically, but I've also tried in each lecture to sort of to emphasize a particular concept or problem that I think has sort of more general applicability to other kinds of film history and other areas of film history as well. And so even though you may not sort of be immediately inspired by the idea of working on Danish silent cinema, I think that hopefully this will be something that can be useful in other areas as well. So I'll start now. The first lecture will be on the beginnings of the feature film in Denmark and the introduction of movies altogether. But there I want to talk about the concept of influence, which is one that is often invoked in many film historical contexts. We say that this or that a filmmaker was influenced by this or that other filmmaker, or that different sort of larger groupings influenced each other. But I think that it's worth examining a bit what exactly that means and how we can sort of use this concept in a perhaps more forceful way. Can you hear me all the way in the back too? Yeah. Yes. Okay. If you need me to speak up, please let me know. Yes. Okay. So, and then after that there'll be an interval, and then I'll talk about some tendencies in the Danish cinema in the period after 1910 that were particularly influential and important, the Autoren film and the use of composition in depth. The Autoren film is of course a German word, and this was a kind of cinema that was particularly popular in Germany, but again, sort of raises some larger issues. And there, I'm going to be talking in particular about tableau style, what that means, what tableaus are, and how we can use that to get a better understanding, particularly of European cinema in the 1910 to 1920 period, where this is sort of a dominant style. And of course, this is something that David Wardwell has worked on extensively. So tomorrow we will start out with talking about sort of another aspect of this, which is the use of lighting for dramatic purposes, and how we might talk about that. And there I want to sort of present the view of film lighting that's been developed by cognitive film theorists, and which in a sense takes a more which doesn't sort of emphasize the changes over the course of film history, but rather sees some of the aesthetic choices as products of a much longer human history, and how that might usefully be employed. Then there'll be a rather longer break, and then I'll talk about the Swedish cinema and how that presented the Danish cinema with an important challenge, and how the Swedes chose a different approach to filmmaking, and how that led to sort of more developed ideas of national film, and more talk at the time about a film in nationalist terms. And on Thursday, the lecturers will both be focused on Carl Theodor Dreyer, who is the best-known Danish film director, and who had a very long career where he made relatively few films, but most of those he made during the silent period, and he moved around between a number of different countries and worked in various different filmmaking styles. And I'm going to first look at the beginnings of his career in Denmark, and how he took up the work with worked in Sweden, and how he sort of addressed the example of the Swedes. And in that context, I'm going to talk about how we can sort of look at his work on different levels. We can look at him as sort of a creative individual, but we can also try to put him into a larger system of filmmaking or different systems that he moved between. And then the final lecture will sort of be mostly dedicated to his last silent film, La Passion de Jeanne d'Arc, which he made in France, and where he sort of drew on the lessons of a number of different European avant-garde or semi-avant-garde stylistic movements, and tried to sort of meld them together into a sort of a very particular work. I'm going to emphasize his sort of relation to the Soviet cinema in particular, because I think that's something which is very important, and has maybe been the importance of that, I think, has not been really fully appreciated. So that's basically sort of the plan for the next 3 days. I'm going to be using quite a few film clips, And I just wanted to point out to you that if you want to watch these movies, quite a few of them you can actually watch online at the website of the Danish Film Institute. This is what it looks like. There's sort of a useful English language overview of Danish film history there as well. But at the top of the page, there, is a search box, and you can put in a film title, and that will then take you to a page for a particular film. This is Den Hvide Slavehandel, the White Slave Trade, which was sort of a very important, I'll talk a bit about it later, a very important 1910 film. There are credits information, but the significant thing here is that down here, there's a box that says film clip, with a film clip, which means film clip, but in many cases, it's actually the whole film you can see there, even though it just says clip. And this is the case, for instance, with Den Hvide Slavehandel. You push play and you can expand it. The quality is not great. These are flash files, but they're still allow you to look at quite a lot of Danish silent films. Of course, the intertitles of many of them are in Danish, which may be a problem for some of you. But again, for the purposes for the purposes of film analysis, this may not be that much of a handicap. So, but I think that this is still a very, very useful resource. And also for many of the films, you can, or for nearly all the films, you can look at stills. Since sort of the dominant company, Nordisk, still exists, a lot of their material has survived, and so we have a very sort of extensive collection of film stills at the Danish Film Institute, and they're all online here too, so you can sort of get a good idea of the way these films were promoted, where posters survive. Those are available as well. And for most films after 1910, there'll be a program booklet as well. This was something that's was sort of standard in Danish cinemas, that you could, for sort of a small surcharge, you could buy a little booklet that would have the credits for the film and a plot synopsis and usually a couple of stills as an illustration. And this is very useful, especially when the films are lost. You can still get a good idea of the storyline of the film from the plot synopses in these booklets. Okay. So, okay. So this lecture will basically be in three parts. I'll start out by talking about the beginnings of cinema in Denmark, and then I'm gonna go into more detail about the concept of influence, and finally I'm gonna talk about the first feature films in 1910, 1911, which was sort of a very important development on a number of levels. So, the first film shows in Denmark were held in June 1896. There were two different shows that happened almost simultaneously. The second one, which was on, I think, June 11th or something like that, where the German Skladanovsky brothers, whom you may have heard of, they demonstrated their bioscope device at the Tivoli Entertainment Gardens. And the bioscope, you can see the apparatus here, was a quite complex apparatus where two film strips were projected simultaneously, and you would shift back and forth between seeing one frame from one strip and one frame from the other strip. So basically the negative or the positive film, each frame was separated from every other frame, and then you would have frame number 1, 3, 5 would be stitched together with little metal studs, and then put into this device. So it was a really complicated device, but still there were moving images. But the news, it was reviewed in the newspapers and saying, this isn't as good as the other one, because there had been another film show a few days before, which was held in this building, which had been put up on the City Hall Square. The building isn't there anymore, but City Hall still is. And this was originally set up as the Free Art Exhibition Building in Denmark. As in many other places, there was sort of the official annual art exhibition of the Royal Academy, and then there was a group of artists whose work were rejected or who didn't want to be associated with the official line, so they got their own exhibition space, like the Secession in Vienna or the Salon des Impressionnistes in France, or so this was sort of on the same model. But for most of the year, of course, the building was available because the exhibition only lasted a couple of months, and it was hired by a fellow named Wilhelm Pacht, who had worked as a stage painter and in various areas, and he set up sort of an entertainment emporium there, which he called the Panorama, which featured a number of different kinds of visual entertainment. This is not from 1896, it's slightly later, and maybe you can see it says Klondike there. So this is probably from 1898, at the time of the Great Alaska Gold Rush, and this would have been a waxworks tableau, where you would see waxworks figures of gold diggers working away in the Yukon. But along with this, there were films too. Here it says "Levende Bilder," which means living pictures or moving images. And this poster here also, and we can see it here, illustrates it. And it's, I think it's the poster is interesting too, because it's a very nice poster, but it's also one that sort of shows us what the owner of the establishment thought his audience was. And I mean, it's sort of mostly, there's a well-to-do lady with an umbrella and two well-to-do gentlemen with top hats. But there's also a delivery boy who's also interested. So there was this sense that this was something that had a popular appeal, but it was still somewhat expensive to go there, and so it wouldn't have been available to all and sundry. But Pacht opened his establishment with moving images on June 7th, 1896, and on the same day, one of the big Copenhagen newspapers carried a review, the very, very, very first Danish film review, and it's quite a fascinating piece, which I'm going to read to you. It was called Kinopticon, which was what the movies were called here. And it goes like this. A kinopticon is, in a popular manner of speaking, only a development of a toy which I remember from my childhood. This toy consisted of a rotating cylinder containing a number of pictures of a horse in different positions, and when you looked through a hole and turned the cylinder, it looked exactly as if it was one and the same horse that moved. So he's talking about a zoetrope, probably. This toy I owned, I remember, for only one day. We had at the school a very beautiful teacher, of whom we were all very fond. Now, it so happened that one day, when the pretty schoolmistress was sitting and writing marks in our books, that I had the idea of climbing up on a chair and kissing her on the back of the neck. I was then 8 years old. The schoolmistress did not mind taking us on her lap and petting us, but she did not like being taken by surprise in this way, and she gave me a bad mark for impertinence. My parents took this as a cause for confiscating the toy, with all sorts of indefinite suggestions that I was a shameless young man who was sure to come to no good, and they gave the delightful invention away to a nephew, whereby they saved the expense of a birthday present, but at the same time sowed the seed in me of a distrust in mankind and a pessimism which has never really abated since. The other schoolmistresses I never kissed because they were ugly. However, since it is not the purpose of this article to write my memoirs, it's best to return to the facts of the matter. That toy, to which so many both sweet and bitter memories have attached themselves in my mind, has later been perfected. Now 900 photographs are taken in 1 minute. These photographs then form a connected series of pictures which, when reproduced speedily in sequence, show us the photographed scene with all its details. This is the briefest and clearest explanation of a canopticon that I, after strenuous speculation, have been able to devise. You sit in the dark and stare at a large piece of mounted white canvas. Then it begins. The canvas comes to life, and various urbane scenes are unrolled before us. We find ourselves in the enclosure during the Derby. There are crowds of people. Some stand impassively staring straight ahead, whereupon they sluggishly wander off. Others rush hastily across the track with banknotes clenched in their hands. Dignified ladies also stroll past with elegant swells eagerly paying court. It is our own Lipotian hermitage field, only infinitely more sophisticated and varied. All at once the machine stops. The minute is over. We're not at the Derby. We're sitting in the rooms of the Independent Exhibition in Copenhagen. Another picture. The coastline of an English landscape. The waves crash against the shore. No people or ships are seen. All you see are the waves rolling closer, dissolving into foam that disappears in tiny drops along the seashore. It is delightful and poetic. The picture is just as simple as and grand, just as varied in its monotony as the ocean itself. And softly, I lose myself in dreams of the summer I spent by the North Sea coast and strolled in the late hours of evening with a young, beautiful lady to whom I so often repeated that I loved her that we both believed it in the end. Those were glorious days. Nature is the best of all. But the third picture is again completely different. It is a train trundling ahead, swiftly at first, then with diminishing speed, right down at the spectators. The station master appears, pompous, as all station masters are. Porters leap up, coach doors are thrown open, ladies and gentlemen climb out, others climb in, the train starts moving again and travels away. And in the window of a first-class compartment stands a lady waving her hand, a delightful young lady with a fine, intelligent face. I look at her closely, I realize it is my true love, going far away, and that I shall probably never see her again, or if I see her, she will be lost to me, and we greet each other and say a few meaningless words. And I cannot understand at all why she does not jerk on the emergency brake and make the train stop and come down to me when she sees I am so utterly sad. But suddenly the electrical machine stops humming and the pictures are gone. The hall lights up again, the seance is over, and I pass into the next room where Mr. Wilhelm Pacht welcomes the press with a glass of foaming champagne. The drink cools me, my mind clears. It is no joke, after all, having to review a canopticon when the heat has reached 30 degrees centigrade. So, this is, I think, a delightful piece written by a fellow named Valdemar Koppel, who became an important newspaper editor later on. And it's interesting both because it gives us some clues about what films were in this very first film show. They were likely English films. Wilhelm Pacht had bought a projector and films from R.W. Paul in England, so the crashing ocean scene is probably the famous Rough Sea at Dover that was shown there. But I also think that it's interesting because it, I think, problematizes somewhat the understanding of the cinema of attractions that film historians have proffered us. The concept of the cinema of attractions is one that was developed in the 1980s by Tom Gunning and André Goudreau. And this was sort of a product of the sort of renewed interest in early cinema that came out of the 1978 FIAF conference in Brighton in England, where a large number of pre-1906 films were screened. And part of what animated these young film historians who were there was that they thought that the films were fascinating, and that the sort of general understanding of early cinema that was prevalent at the time, which was that the earliest films were somehow a kind of childhood stage, that film sort of grew the same way a living being grows, and that it had to sort of grow into maturity with the arrival of the narrative feature film, with D.W. Griffith's great films from the mid-teens and so on, and that the others were sort of things that were sort of infantile by comparison. And they thought, well, you know, this turns these really, really interesting early films into something that really just makes sense as the precondition of something else that comes on later on. But they thought, no, these films are fascinating in themselves, and they should be seen as sort of their own thing rather than a less developed case of something that arrives later on. And so by sort of drawing on Sergei Eisenstein's concept of the attraction, they thought that it made sense to look at these films as similar to fairground attractions of various sorts, acrobats, other kinds of performances. And they thought what these films have in common is that they somehow say, look at this, and that in that way they were exhibitionists, whereas sort of the later Hollywood story films were illusionist, and that the early films sort of addressed the spectator much more directly than later narrative films do, and so there is, and Gunning also sort of connects this look at this to the experience of shocks, which some people have talked about as characteristic of the experience of the late 19th century metropolis with its streetlights and its noise and bustle and so on, that it was sort of filled with shocks and sensations and so on. And you know, there's certainly a lot of things to be said for this interpretation. But sort of the explicit, the opposite of this kind of shock experience is the idea of absorption, and that's something that's sort of connected to the illusionism. And and that in the fiction film you become sort of absorbed into the story, and there's sort of a forgetting of yourself which is not really present in the cinema of attractions. However, here we have sort of a contemporary witness who is nothing if not absorbed into the image, and you know, these tiny 1 minute films sort of become the basis for these really, really elaborate reveries, and he sort of makes this, they have this very, very strong imaginative effect on him, and I think that that's something which is sort of maybe a little hard to reconcile with at least some of the more drastic formulations of what the cinema of attractions is, and so I think that perspective is important to keep in mind as well. Okay, but again, probably the films that Pacht showed were mostly English. He may have had some Edison films as well, later probably would add some French productions also. And in at Christmas, they should actually both be 1897. I don't know why oops. I don't know how that happened. Okay, that much better. Christmas 1897, there was the first show of Danish-made films. And again, a newspaper review tells us that at least these two films were shown. Brandvæsenet rykker ud means the fire department goes off on what do you call it, when you know, the fire engines leaving the station, and then in Copenhagen there are these lakes that used to be the old city moat, and there are swans in them, you see the feeding of the swans in the other film, and both of them survive. And here they are. The quality is not great, I'm afraid, but it'll give you sort of an idea of what. This was a very popular topic. You can hardly see it, but this is a house that's burned down, and you see the firemen pouring water on it. But this was, of course, a very sort of popular topic with early filmmakers. In most film production companies, in most film producing countries, you have films of the fire department in action. And here you have the swans being fed. And I mean, these films were both shown at Pacht's Panorama, and for the first sort of decade of Danish film history, mostly films were shown at entertainment establishments of various kinds that had other shows as well. The first really viable cinemas opened in 1904, 1905. This is the first one, Cosmorama, which opened in September 1904. and you can still see the place where it's at Östergade. And then Biograftheater, which came along in April 1905, and that was also in Strøget, which is sort of the main shopping street of Copenhagen. And this one was founded by Ole Olsen, who was a fairground fairground performer who had toured with sort of shows in going back to the 1880s. He'd been the head of a large amusement park in Sweden, and there he had had a film show as part of the amusement park. And he then decided that he would set up a cinema in 1905, and these cinemas became quite popular. And at the same time, of course, you have the same tendency in many other countries. You have these sort of relatively small permanent cinemas set up, usually seating maybe 100 to 200 people, set up in sort of in pre-existing commercial spaces, rooms that were that had been shops or restaurants before and were then sort of converted to use for cinemas. They're not yet sort of purpose-built buildings. But these small storefront cinemas were quite successful, and so there is internationally a very swiftly rising demand for films, because film shows would change quite frequently, often several times a week, and that means that many more films are required to fill in programs, and so a number of these cinema managers then set up, they go into film production as well, and that's what Ole Olsen also did. He set up Nordisk Filmskompagni in 1906 as a production company, and Olsen was quite aware of this sort of rising international demand, so he very quickly expanded to other countries. This sort of commercial folder is, we're not absolutely sure what date it is, but it's probably 1909. But by this time, they have offices in, or branches in London and New York, as well as Berlin, Vienna, Genova, St. Petersburg, Barcelona, Buenos Aires, Paris, etc. So Nordisk very early on set up a global distribution of films. And as you can see on the top, it says drama, scenic, comedy, which in a sense were sort of the main genres operative at the time, there was still the programs in these small cinemas would be relatively short and typically consist of several different kinds of films. And there was a lot of experimentation in this period, and sort of different genres and different kinds of audience appeal being experimented with. And I think this cartoon sort of suggests some of the discussions that were going on at the time. It features movie posters, and most of these films are or film titles are authentic or close to it. You have Modern Surgery, Dr. Krasman's wonderful operations, then The Red Hand, The Scourge of New York, then The White Slave Trade from the depths of the great city, Buried Alive, gripping scenes, and these are all marked educational films. And then you have historical scenes, the double murder in Skellerup, excellently reconstructed, the victim of the guillotine, the Knight of St. Bartholomew, beautifully colored, and the torture chamber in the hands of the Inquisition. And finally, from the animal world, you have in the jaws of the crocodile, feeding snakes with live rabbits, and through the slaughterhouses of Chicago. And then it says, children, 5p. Which of course sort of suggests that a lot of really gruesome films were being shown, and that there were considerable worries about young people and people from the lower classes and so on being exposed to stuff that would be unhealthy for them. And you know, this is actually sort of less of a parody than it might seem. I've seen one of the films of snakes, of live rabbits being fed to snakes, and it, you know, you cute rabbit and whoop. It's quite something. There's a Pathé film showing the tortures of the Inquisition, which is also really, really, which is quite strong. And of course, there was a famous French surgeon named Doyen, whose operations were filmed, and the films were distributed as commercial entertainment. And you know, these are actual surgeries, and this was sort of before the bacteriological revolution had sort of set through fully. So you see Doyen, he operates without face mask, without gloves, and he, you know, he operates on these people who have the most amazing tumors. And so he moves in, he cuts open the leg, and he puts in his head, goes like this, and pulls out a tumor the size of a watermelon. And, you know, there were some of these films shown at the at this festival for Rediscovered Films in Bologna some years ago, and there were several walkouts for that one. And a lot of people were really, really scandalized by this. And of course, since then, sort of medical films of this sort have moved out of the public view and are sort of subject to all kinds of restrictions, and only sort of authorized people can watch them. But, you know, this was something that hadn't sort of really been fully established then. And so these worries were not sort of didn't come out of thin air. And there were films that were sort of largely, and I mean some of the ones that were featured in this parody were sort of attraction-based, that they didn't really sort of have a story as sort of their main thing, but rather were designed about this sort of look at this. And one of the most famous and influential ones was The Lion Hunt, Løvejagten, which was shot in 1907, and it was actually sort of a follow-up to another one called The Polar Bear Hunt, which had been shot in 1906 and sort of also helped inspire the famous polar bear logo for the Nordisk Film Company. But in both cases, Ole Olsen purchased wild animals from the Hagenbeck zoological gardens in Germany and had them shot on camera in settings that, you know, would indicate that you were in Africa in the case of the lion hunt, or in the Arctic in the case of the polar bear hunt. You weren't in this case. The lion hunt, the scenes with the lions were shot on this really, really, really tiny island, not much bigger than this room, called Ereua in a fjord some distance from Copenhagen, and so there was this sort of mockery very early on attached to the film. And what I have here is bits of the film that were included in sort of a film historical compilation that was done in the late 20s, sort of looking back on the history of Danish film till then. And here, you know, the film is fitted out with these mocking intertitles, making fun of how ridiculous this whole thing was. But still, in a sense, the attraction was quite real. I think you can't really see that, but a horse and a sheep, I think, was sort of given to the lions to eat before they were shot, and so you have these rather sort of strong scenes of animal violence in the film. And then the scenes from El Or were then cut together with scenes that had been shot elsewhere, photos of African animals from the Copenhagen Zoo, and scenes of the hunters moving through a forest, to give sort of the impression that you were dealing with a real African expedition. The film took place in darkest Africa, and this was magicked about by planting a few palms on the island of Ereua. Equipped with beards and tropical outfits, the fearful lion hunters approach. On the left is Ole Olsen. This is actually not true. On the right, Sergeant Larsen, then one of the most frequently used performers in Danish film. Note the role cigarettes seem to have played in the part of the lion hunters. Both lay down to sleep, cigarette in mouth, and in the following, in any serious situation, they will light up again. First lion appears. And there you could briefly see the lion with its kill. Ha, 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 ha.
lion number two is about to go down. The lion itself was probably scared out of its wits. The hunters deal with the situation with the help of cigarettes, and everything is over and done with. Even the Negro gets a cigarette. But they don't share a match with him. Obviously, you know, a film like this is sort of ripe for all kinds of post-colonial analysis, but it was also a really, really big success both in Denmark and elsewhere, and inspired Pathé to do a number of very similar films. Only the Pathé films were actually shot in Africa, and they sent the important Belgian director Alfred Machin off to Africa, and he did a number of films there. Where you see leopards and giraffes being killed and skinned, usually carefully colored with Pathé's stencil color process. So this film was a very significant one, and it is one that where sort of the attraction is watching the wild animals and watching them be killed, and when there isn't really any story per se, the hunters are only characters in the most rudimentary sense. But in most cases, during this time after 1906, story films become more and more important. And that includes both dramatic films of various sorts, but also comedies. And again, the comedies may sort of only have very, very loose or rudimentary storylines. This one, The Anarchist's Mother-in-Law, from 1906, is sort of mainly situation based, but it does have sort of a sort of basic joke like storyline. The mother-in-law comes to visit, and what then happens? As you'll be able to see, the Nordisk logo with the polar bear on top of the globe has been devised already and appears on some of the sets, and this was something that was done to prevent piracy, in order to prevent other film companies from just copying your films and selling them on. Filmmakers or film production companies in this period would include company logos on the sets themselves, so you'll see French films with the Pâté cockerel or the Gaumont flower. You'll see American films with the AB American Biograph logo and the polar bear here. And again, like some of the attraction genres, this kind of relatively violent knockabout comedy was a genre that was popular, but looked upon with a certain suspicion by the guardians of established culture. It was thought to be lowbrow and to appeal to the lower classes, and because of the tendency to use destruction and violence for the purpose of jokes, it was thought that it might sort of lessen the seriousness of these kinds of things and decrease respect for property and so on. So films like this helped make the cinema in this period to give it sort of image problems, because it had come out of the fairground. A lot of people sort of thought of cinema as a sort of a lower class amusement, and stuff like the anarchist's mother-in-law may have sort of contributed to that. Hang on. Wait a minute. It was supposed to be there.
obviously the gender politics here are dubious at best. Thinking of the movies as sort of a crass and violent entertainment for the lower classes was something that some film producers and filmmakers sought to counteract. In France there were there was a society there was a company set up called Société le Film d'Art, the art film company, which had as its goal to make films that could be considered to be works of art, they made several and had sort of a large presentation in 1908 with a group of films, some featuring dancers doing sort of recreations of what classical Athenian dance may have been like, probably not, but still there was this sort of clear connection to classical culture. But sort of the climax of the program was a 15-minute film called The Murder of the Duke of Guise, which dramatized an event from 16th century French history during the Wars of Religion in France. The French king had one of the most powerful noblemen in France, the Duke of Guise, assassinated because he feared that he might be sort of a competitor to the French throne. The film had actors from the Comédie Française, the most prestigious French theatre, as it says on the programme, Monsieur Le Bragy from the Comédie Française, Monsieur Lambert from the Comédie Française, Dieudonné from the Théâtre de la Renaissance, and the two leading ladies were from the Comédie Française as well. So this was, in a sense, sort of one of the key reasons why the film was considered to be art, was that real artists, that is, actors from the legitimate theatre, appeared in it. But to sort of underscore the significance of the film, the Société Film d'Art hired Camille Saint-Saëns, the famous composer, to write a score for the film. And you can hear a little of it. This is an excerpt from an English television series called Film Europe, The Other Hollywood. And the music you hear is the music that Saint-Saëns composed for the film. It's just a brief clip showing sort of the climax of the film, the assassination itself.
The films were made to resemble lavishly mounted stage plays. A company calling itself Film d'Art commissioned a score by the 73-year-old composer Saint-Saëns. France's greatest actress, Sarah Bernhardt, recognized the new status of the cinema. It was this hour-long production which introduced the feature film to America.
The commentator here says that that's Kenneth Branagh, by the way, says that these films were inspired by the stage, but actually you can see that the staging of the assassination itself is very clearly based on this painting by Paul Delaroche from 1834. I mean, sort of the setup has been changed slightly, but you have the same idea of the assassins pointing to the dead body. You have the king hiding behind a curtain until the deed is done. But again, this is also part of what makes this film art, is that it draws on the other established arts, including painting as well, and we'll return to that in more detail in the next lecture as well. It's also worth pointing out that these film d'art productions have often been accused of being theatrical, and that sort of appears in Branagh's commenting as well. But actually, if you look at the murder, you can see that it's actually quite complexly staged, and the scene moves. It starts out in one room, and the assassins pull out their knives, and then they move to another room, and then to a third room. So you actually have quite a lot of editing and changes of camera setups within this brief sequence, much more so than you would find in a lot of other European films from this time or even later. So that's perhaps a bit up there. But anyway, this film was shown in Copenhagen as well, and Viggo Larsen, who directed most films at Nordisk until the end of 1909 and appeared in many of them as well, including both The Lion Hunt and The Anarchist's Mother-in-Law, has said later that he saw L'Assassinat du Duc de Guise and was thrilled and inspired by it. It helped bring forth and popularize the idea that films could be art, and to sort of make the term art film, Kunstfilm in Danish, a regularly used one. But of course, this situation here, where we have a film that sort of directly emulates a pre-existing artwork and in turn inspires other works, brings us to the idea of there the Anarchist's Mother-in-Law is, but we've seen it, so to the concept of influence. And the roots of influence is the Latin influere, which means flow into, and it's the same word as you have in influenza, because the flow involved comes from the explanation that was devised to explain why astrology works, because in the early modern period, of course, it was astrology was a respected science, and it was thought that it worked perfectly well. But the only question is, how do the stars? Because we know that the stars determine what happens with people, but how exactly does that work? And so someone came up with the idea that the stars passed down an invisible liquid to humans, and that this
through this individual, in this liquid, the stars influenced the lives of humans. And, you know, this is sort of a strangish idea, but that's where the concept of influence comes from. And that's it's this flow that passes down from the stars. And influenza was thought to be a disease that was caused by these sort of cosmic flows as well. But the thing is that there you have sort of a relatively determinist way of looking at it. The idea is that there is this sort of outside force that that works on humans, and the way influence is often used sort of takes this meaning along with it, and the word is used in such a way that the past becomes the active force. The past influences the future. And when you say that this filmmaker influenced this other filmmaker, what usually happens is that you have someone in the past who somehow, through some strange occult force, is able to sort of make someone later on do something in a particular way, which is a rather strange way of looking at it when you think about it. And this is something which has been sort of very usefully pointed out in this book, Patterns of Intention, a book from 1987, which is well worth reading. It's out of print, unfortunately. I just discovered this. But it's by a very famous art historian named Michael Baxendall. And in this book, he looks at a small number of very famous paintings and sort of tries to explain why they look the way they look historically. And there he discusses the idea of influence and how it has this sort of the idea that it's sort of a determining force that comes out of the past and hits the future, and he sort of analogizes it with sort of the philosopher Hume's idea of causation as kind of a game of billiards, and there on this reading, of course, the past in a sense is the billiard cue. That then hits the cue ball and makes it move in a particular direction. So the past causes the future. That's wrong, says Baxendall. That's not the way it works. Rather, if we sort of stay within the sort of the metaphor of billiards, what happens is that the past does present the present with sort of a particular layout of the balls, so that there is that certain options are available and certain options are not. But in the end, it's sort of the person in the present who has to decide how to respond to how the pool table has been laid out for him by the past. And I think that's it's a very powerful way of thinking about this. And when we talk about influence, I think that it's important to remember that it's not something that we should really imagine to have sort of a direct causal force. But on the other hand, that certainly if people do something in a particularly impressive way, it may sort of make the menu of options available for later latecomers look a particular way. And so in this sense, a film like Les Assassinats du Duc de Guise, by sort of establishing the option of the art film, certainly could be said to sort of to change the layout of the table and make certain options more salient for later filmmakers. But and so I think it's in that way reasonable to say that it did have an effect on the way that the art film developed in Denmark, even though the Danish films that were called art films were not sort of historical dramas, costume pictures like Les Assassinats du Duc de Guise and most of the other productions that the Société Film d'Art put out. Most of those were precisely costume pictures, either historical films or films based on biblical stories or Shakespeare or sort of other classic works of literature. In Denmark, the art film breaks through with the feature film, and the first feature films. There are some films that are not feature films that are art films, but there is a clear overlap, feature length here means films that sort of go beyond the length of one reel, which had sort of been sort of the generally accepted maximum length for film was one reel of film, which was about 15 minutes, and it was thought people will have a hard time sitting still or concentrating on one story for more than 15 minutes at a time. But of course, in the theater, people were able to watch films for much longer, and so some people may have wondered, well, you know, why not make longer films? A very important milestone there was a film called The White Slave Trade, Nye Slavehandel, from 1910. Actually, it's two films, because it was originally made by a smaller production company named Fotorama, in Aarhus, Danish, the second city in Denmark, and then Nordisk made a rip-off where they sent someone to look at the film in the cinema, make notes, and then do a scene-by-scene remake of the original. And the original is lost. We have only the copy. But of course there, with this kind of piracy, you're sort of moving into something which goes sort of beyond acceptable influence. But there, certainly, this was something that was seen as a commercial opportunity that was so important that Nordisk thought, we have to get into this. Den Hvide Slavehandel, both versions are three reels, so they're about 45 minutes long. When it came out, the first one came out in Aarhus in April 1910. It was a massive success, and you can see in the newspapers that on the first day it would play every 45 minutes. So there wouldn't be a lot of time. I mean, there would just be a few minutes between each show. But on the second day, they had to change it so that the film was shown only once per hour, because there were so many people that it simply took almost 15 minutes to empty the theater and fill it up again. So it was really a massive hit. It's a story about a young girl who answers an advertisement to become a chambermaid in a foreign city, which seems to be London. And when she arrives, it turns out that she's not going to work as a chambermaid, but in a brothel. So she's been trafficked, and her fiancé is suspicious and sets off and finds her and is able to rescue her
at the last minute. This was a story that had previously been used as a short film made by Nordisk in 1906, and which was also had been shown on. There had been at least two different stage plays that were both called The White Slave Trade. And before that, there was also a novel called The White Slave, which again sort of has the same motif. So it was sort of a very tried and tested device. But this film was promoted as an art film. It says Kunstfilm in the in the advertising, on the basis of the fact that the actors who appear in it were actors from the legitimate theater who had been who had allowed themselves to be hired to make this film. And so for that reason, even though it's sort of a rather sort of sensationalistic, lurid sex story, it could be promoted as art because of this presence of established actors. Here is a brief scene from the Nordisk version. It's one that that Bordwell talks a little about in his article on the tableau aesthetic, which we'll return to in the next lecture. But it's just one take, but you'll see how it's quite carefully blocked, and sort of the movements of the actors are sort of used to direct our attentions. But it's still something. It's something that will be developed much further in the years that follow. A party at the slave dealers. Here is our heroine. She's not enthusiastic about the whole thing. This is our hero. He sort of move to the front of the image, where they sort of communicate silently, unobserved by the others, but evident to us, the spectators. He's telling her that he will come and rescue her later on, probably. This idea that you can, I mean, this is, again, part of what has made some later film historians talk about this kind of film as theatrical, is that you have this use of this kind of device that you certainly find in stage plays as well, that you sort of have
communication going on between two characters that the other characters in the same space don't notice, and the way that they sort of make it secret is by moving closer to the audience. So they step all the way up to the front of the stage and they whisper to each other, and we accept the convention that this means that the people standing further back on the stage can't overhear what's going on. And so you have suddenly devices like this, which are very, very similar or identical even to what you'd see on stage, but there are important twists to that which we shall return to. So art films were films with artists in them, and sort of the second feature film to appear in 1910 was Aukorten, The Abyss, which came out in September, and again was produced by a small production company, but which starred Asta Nielsen, who became a very, very important international film star, partly on the strength of the international success of this film. And again, it was a film telling sort of a really simple story of a young girl who sort of she's engaged to a nice guy, but then she runs off with a circus cowboy instead because he's hotter. But he's no good, so she ends up killing him in jealousy, and that's basically the story. It's sort of a simple melodramatic story with no literary pretensions. But again, the actors were from the legitimate stage. Asta Nielsen had some trouble finding work, but she was already known as a stage actress. Paul Reumert, who plays the cowboy or the gaucho as he is, was also a rising figure on the Danish stage, and so you have this sort of combination of a melodramatic story with established actors, so you could call it an art film. And at the same time, like the White Slave Trade, you had a sort of a very strong and evident erotic component, that this was a story of erotic passion, and I mean sort of the whole idea of her running away is obviously about the erotic attraction of the cowboy, and this was sort of underlined by a performance that happens within the film where Asta Nielsen and the cowboy do a dance. I mean, they work as performers, but it also sort of reflects the overall sort of arc of the story. And this dance is blatant in its eroticism. The print of Aukorten that survived was a very, very worn one, and if you look at it on the DFI website, it's actually been shined up. I think the one that's on there has been shined up digitally, but it looked really, really grotty. But the gaucho dance here is high quality, and the reason is that this particular bit was cut out by the Swedish film censors, and they saved it. And so there was sort of a pristine copy of that, which the Swedes back then weren't allowed to see because it was much too strong. And we will conclude this part of the show with that.
Okay, thank you. And we start again in 20 minutes. Yes.